This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Are principals relying too much on suspensions? And through a rise in student suspensions in Victoria, are we creating a new wave of youth crime? I'm Mary Guerin, and in this Conversation Hour, we will be continuing the conversation this morning about what we've learned about the sharp rise in public school suspensions last year. Almost 30,000 up in 2025, up more than 1,000 on 2024. We'll speak to an academic in Queensland who's looked at 12 years of data from that state, who says there is a clear link between increased suspensions at school and youth crime. Last June, as we know, the state government gave Victorian school principals greater power to suspend or expel students, specifically for misbehaviour outside of school or online that poses serious risk. And at the time, the Education Minister, Ben Carroll, said, look, these are strengthened powers to send a clear message that harmful behaviour outside of school or online has consequences. We've invited Ben Carroll onto the show. He's on leave. We're still waiting. We've asked who might be able to speak in his place. We don't know yet, but I'm asking you, what do you think? What do suspensions do to a student in your view? Is it a wake-up call for them, an important education in consequences? Or do you think it's a step along a slippery slope to worse mental health for kids, isolation, even to crime? What else should principals be looking at in your view, if you think that latter argument? What should else they should be looking at when they are looking at taking a kid under their arm, their wing, or when they are going down the wrong path? What is enough? What is appropriate? Tell me what you think. Also, should we be able to have a different kind of farewell from this mortal coil? We're talking about a delicate subject today. It's about burials, or at least not necessarily burials, what we do with our human bodies once we are leaving it. Yes, there is a call in New South Wales for something called human composting. It's a little confronting, but what it basically means is natural decomposition of a human body in a vessel. So not burial in the ground, not cremation, not even the eco-burials we have in sustainable coffins. It's not legal in Australia at the moment, but an independent MP in New South Wales has proposed a bill to legalise it there. Is that an option you would like to see? We've seen a rise in popularity of these eco-burials or green burials. This seems to be the next step. Do you think? Does that appeal to you? Also, happy solstice day for yesterday. Did you celebrate with a nude swim or even just a winter swim? Tell me about your winter swimming. Some hardy souls were jumping in the cold ditch off Hobart this morning as part of Dark Mofo. Tell me about your winter swimming. Tell me how you keep going day after day in winter or year after year. How long have you been winter swimming? What are the tips on these chilly mornings of how to get out of bed and jump in that water? Convince me about winter swimming. Let me know. All that and more. But next, are principals relying too much on suspensions in schools?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So last June, Victorian principals were given new powers to suspend or expel students when their behaviour outside school or online put other students or staff at serious risk. Now some figures have come out through Freedom of Information laws, through The Age reporting, saying that about 150 students are suspended each school day in Victoria, and that's up on the previous year. So that's between 2024 and 2025. My next guest has been looking at what increased powers for principals, similarly, has done in Queensland over 12 years. And she argues that there is a link between those suspensions and youth crime. Yvonne in Eltham, you wanted to say something? Hi, Yvonne.
Oh, hi. Look, I was just wondering whether, look, I don't agree with people getting straps with the leather strap and all that sort of stuff either, because I was brought up in the days when any kids that was naughty got that sort of thing. It was pretty horrible. And I just wondered instead, providing the psychologists say it's a good thing, maybe what they should do instead of suspending them is say, righto, well, you can do some school community service. We need to have, you know, this gardening done or this floor cleaned up or these, you know, something like that, and do something to help the school and make them feel a little bit ashamed, because everyone will know, hey, you haven't done the right thing, so you're being punished this way instead of learning.
You think that that's part of the toolkit that school principals should have?
Yeah, I reckon.
Yvonne, thank you so much for your call and your thoughts. I'll put that to my next guest. Linda J. Graham is Professor and Director of the Centre for Inclusive Education at the Queensland University of Technology and joins me now. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Good, thank you. I want to get to Yvonne's suggestions in a moment there, Linda, but let's set the table here, I guess. What was your response to these figures in Victoria, and what link did you make to the expanded powers that happened in Victoria last year?
So my response is, I guess, disappointment mixed with frustration, because it's entirely predictable that there would be a large increase. And you know, we have seen that here in Queensland. There were also similar increases in New South Wales. So the government there has recently walked back some of the changes that they had made, which was, you know, really well done by them to actually admit that, hey, there's a problem here. But it seems that the Victorian government hasn't maybe looked a little bit more widely and predicted what those changes in policy would mean for young people.
And Linda, I was prefacing this by saying that you have made the link between what happened in Queensland in 2014, where there were boosted powers, and an increase in youth crime. Just before we start, I've already got texts questioning what is called by this texter appalling logic to link the suspensions with causing youth crime. As someone says, correlation is not causation. Tell us about why and how you've made that link.
So look, it's not an appalling link. It's actually pretty well known that suspension, like internationally well known, that suspension is a key predictor for police contact. So, you know, when you send kids home from school, quite often they're not supervised. And when they're not supervised, they're out and about in the streets, getting up to mischief, mixing with older antisocial peers and becoming involved in youth crime in that way. There's also a whole range of other effects that suspension, you know, kind of, it's a cumulative thing, especially for very young and vulnerable children, because they get suspended again and again and again. So, you know, you put all of that together, and what it does is it weakens social bonds with school, belonging goes down, connectedness goes down, relationships, you know, become a problem, and then you start to have truancy. We're even getting students suspended for truancy. And so, yeah, unfortunately, what we've had in Queensland is back in 2014, the Campbell Newman government of the time changed the legislation in much the same way that Ben Carroll's government has done in Victoria, basically expanding principal's power to suspend. And we've looked at, you know, what effect that had. And suspensions went through the roof very, very quickly. And particularly at two different time points. So for children who were entering school, so prep children suspensions doubled and then tripled. So we were having suspensions of around 1,500, you know, 5-year-olds every year. And then the other time point was year seven, because those children were, you know, entering high school for the first time. So the suspension rates in year seven doubled. And the problem is that you've got more kids getting suspended, more often. And then those kids grow up.
Mm.
And that's what we're starting to see, I believe, in Queensland, where, you know, we do have a, I wouldn't call it a generalised youth crime problem, but it is well known that we have a group of young people called the 400, serious and repeat offenders. And we just need to have a look at their suspension histories, because I can guarantee you those teenagers were the children that were being suspended in prep year one, year two, a decade ago.
Mm. And how do you rule out then the prevalence of other factors in their lives that might be more to do with the youth crime, you know, that correlation factor of it, you know, it being about their background or about their home environment as opposed to suspensions?
Absolutely. So those vulnerable children, I mean, it's really interesting to me when people say, oh, but, you know, almost like it's a fait accompli, right? That, you know, those children were going to end up suspended or end up in crime no matter what. Well, so you can't actually do, you know, experimental research that looks at this, because that would be unethical, right?
Yes.
So the way that you can look at it is to control for various factors, right? So you can control for disadvantage. You can control for, you know, kids having a single mother. You can control for, you know, even the type and size of school that they came from. You can control for disability. You can control for Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, background. And we've done that actually recently with New South Wales data. And what we have found in that is that police, like, so suspension is a significant predictor and it's associated with police contact, even when you take all of those other factors into account. Mm. So it contributes by itself.
You're listening to Linda Graham, who is from the Queensland of Technology, University of Technology. We are talking about suspensions and whether or not that leads to youth crime, that possibility. Linda, I'm seeing it as well on text a lot in the flavour of, well, look, this teaches kids consequences. Certainly we know that the expanded powers were specifically targeting acts that put fellow students or staff at serious risk. So it seems as if it's not just for anything. Isn't that fair enough in your view?
Look, suspension has a place when, for example, there is an act of like major and serious violence. But that we do have to be very careful about that. And what our research has shown is that, in fact, those types of incidents are quite rare. You know, like in the South Australia inquiry that we conducted, we found maybe, I think it was 48 incidents like that from thousands of incidents. So like 11,000 suspension incidents, only 48 of them were like that, right? So, you know, we're talking pretty minuscule. So suspension does have a place where, for example, there is violence where, you know, and that is also premeditated. I think one of the problems that we do have is that we have a lot of young people with a disability who are overrepresented. We've also got, you know, kids from trauma backgrounds who are in care and so forth. And so we have to be careful that we are not suspending kids who become emotionally overwhelmed because adjustments are not being made. So, you know, that is another critical issue that we have with schools. And a far better solution, and this is why, you know, I see these kinds of figures with frustration and disappointment is because we know that there are vastly better options. And if ministers really do have principles backs, then why are they not supporting principles to do what most principles actually want to do?
Yeah. And before I let you go, Linda, I'll put Yvonne's suggestions to you. Yvonne called before and was talking about getting kids to do school community services like gardening or the floor. She mentioned the element of shame also in terms of doing it in front of kids. Just quickly, what do you think of that sort of way of helping kids through? Does it?
I was smiling when Yvonne made the comment because I was remembering having to pick up papers in the playground once upon a time. And
you did. What did you do, Linda?
I got suspended many times.
Oh, there you go. Interesting. And you ended up okay, is what our listeners might be thinking.
Well, I did, but I also got expelled from school. So, you know. But
your research says otherwise.
Yeah, well, that's right. But I was very lucky. I had a wonderful family who supported me. And I think it is, but we also do have to, as a society, we need to step in and look after the kids who don't have that family background and who cannot, who are not able to make their way in the world in a positive way. And the keys, what Yvonne suggested is not actually out of step. I would make a couple of caveats. One is that we should not be aiming to punish or to shame. Mm-hmm. What we should be aiming to do is provide an educative response that teaches kids the skills that they actually need to be able to, do what they're supposed to in school, right? Mm. The reason that so many kids are getting suspended is because they lack the self-regulation. So many of them have ADHD, right? But part of the issue is that they act before thinking. We need to teach them the skills to act, to think before they act and to make responsible decisions. And that might not be modelled to them at home. So the rest of us in society need to do that for them. And schools need to be supported to be able to achieve that.
Linda, thank you so much for kicking off what I can see already on the text line is such a lively conversation for people. And, well, look good on you for getting past those suspensions and even the expulsion to become professor.
Yep. Thanks a lot.
Linda J. Graham is Professor and Director of the Centre for Inclusive Education at the Queensland University of Technology on the Conversation Hour. This on text from Patrick. Gosh, shocked to hear of suspensions in prep. Someone else picked up on that. Prep being suspended. For goodness sake, these kids must be special needs. So bring more teacher's aid in. Another person says, I've had three of my son's friends suspended and then expelled in year 12 this year. They're now thriving after working through things. And more on text saying, oh, please, it's the role of teachers to run a safe and orderly classroom. Suspensions tell student and the people who brought them onto the world that their behaviour is not acceptable. Keep those calls and texts coming. It's obviously a very complex conversation. It won't be resolved in just one chat, but I'd still love to hear your thoughts and your stories. But coming up later also in this conversation hour, are you, and I had to learn this word today, a Kionophile? A winter lover? Did you celebrate the solstice with some winter swimming? I'd love to hear how you celebrate winter, particularly if it is winter swimming, as happens. What are your tips in that regard? Also in this hour, we're going to be talking about the big movements ahead in UK politics again. But next, would you like the option to choose what is called, somewhat confrontingly, but quite naturally a process, human composting as an option as you farewell this life? You're on Conversation Hour, 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
I don't know if you've read this already, but there's an independent in New South Wales, an independent MP, Alex Greenwich, who has tabled a bill to allow for what is called human composting as an option. So not a burial at all, not even in an eco coffin or indeed a cremation. But this is not legal in Australia. New South Wales would be the first place if that does happen. Is that something that you would like to see? Well, it does happen elsewhere in the world. I'm going to get very soon to an advocate who has been working for this for some time. But Teresa, you're calling from Sydney and you have something to do with this process. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I was the person who went to Alex Greenwich and said, can you change the law so that we can do human composting, first of all in New South Wales and then around all of the country.
And why did you do that?
I did that because my daughter 4 years ago showed me a video of how it's happening in the US, mostly in the Pacific Northwest was where they set up. And I just thought I wanted to save the planet. You save a ton of carbon approximately for every person who you compost rather than bury or cremate. And you end up with about a cubic metre or 100, I think that's about 110 kilos of beautiful, rich compost that you can give back to families for memorialisation purposes, or you can donate it to projects that are regenerating degraded land. So it seemed like a really sensible thing.
So you'd want to do it yourself, Teresa?
Oh, listen, that's why I'm doing it. But the other thing that I worked out was there's two things wrong with the way that we look after our dead now. One is the environmental cost, but the other is the financial cost. So I've set up a charity called Earthly Legacy, and I'm planning to do this as a charity. So I'll be charging wealthy greenies like myself a normal amount, and all of profits will go into increasing the environmental and social impact of the organisation by letting the poor and the destitute get composted as well for either a small fee or for free.
And so you've set this up in anticipation of it becoming legal?
I've been doing a lot of work and, yep, I've set up the charity and I'm in the process of inventing the vessel, the transformation vessel here in Australia. I went and looked at what was happening in the US and asked them could I buy it or license it, and it was an outrageous amount of money, so I'm just reinventing it here because it's agricultural science, it's not rocket science.
Wow, Teresa, you are clearly not just a fan, but really wanting to make it work into the future. Thank you so much for getting in touch.
You're welcome, thanks.
So that's Teresa, who apparently kicked off this whole process. What do you think? 1300 222 774. Is that how you'd like to go? What questions have you got? Give us a call, 1300 222 774. Joining me now is Tui Davidson, who is human composting advocate from Earthly Remains, and maybe she can answer some of your calls about this because she, like Teresa, has been on this for a while. Hello, Tui. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, Mary, and all your listeners.
Tell me, how long have you been advocating for this and why?
Well, about 7 years ago, a friend's dad died, and he was an urban planner who was very committed to sustainability, and his values was something which, you know, I'd known about. He was a family friend as well as being a friend's dad. And so when she was quite unhappy at some of the aspects of his funeral and the fact that there wasn't some environmentally sustainable options, and I started to look into it and ran down a rabbit hole of just how disposition, what we do with dead bodies at the very end, really comes down to only two options: burial and cremation. We, you know, natural burial's a thing and that's great, but it's tying up land. It's finite, the land available, it's very expensive. And
So just to interrupt you there, Tui, so what you're talking about when you say environmental funerals, you're talking about the increasingly popular use of biodegradable caskets and so forth. They go in the ground, and you're saying that's fundamentally different from what we're talking about here.
Yes. Yes, I am. So, yes, there's a lot of work being done so that we're not using embalming fluids and so that we don't have to use hardwood coffins with lots of glues and lacquers and things, and moving to shrouds and wicker caskets and cardboard coffins. But then there's still the next step, which is the disposition of the body, which is either the burial in the ground or the cremation. Cremation emits toxins and pollutants into the air. I'm an asthmatic with chronically poor airways, and I feel quite strongly that air pollution is environmentally bad. The Lung Foundation is very clear in its information that air pollution is bad, and we all learnt through COVID that there are particles in the air that we can't even see that are bad for us. And so cremation, your person that you get back as a box of ashes, well, that's just a box of ashes. The rest of them's gone out on the airways as pollutants. There are filters in the newer cremators, and a lot of work's being done to make that environmentally better. But between tying up land, which is finite and expensive and still is a slow leachate into groundwater, and you know, it has an environmental cost, and cremations, which has this environmental cost of emissions and uses fossil fuels, I just thought there had to be something else.
Mm.
And around the world, other options are being done. There's alkaline hydrolysis, which is a water cremation, which I was the first thing I, you know, the rabbit hole I started off with, and really believed in it because Desmond Tutu was alkaline hydrolysis water cremated. And so I thought, oh, there's this, the option, the environmental sustainability I'm looking for.
Mm.
But in fact, that is, we're a drought continent.
Yeah.
I don't think a water cremation really is the right option. So I kept looking and found human composting.
Human composting. And you set up Earthly Remains. We're talking to Tui Davidson. We're talking about human composting. I'm already getting texts, Tui, saying, yes, please, I want to be compost. I want to grow trees when I'm gone. Makes perfect sense. I want to return to the earth. That's from Carmelina in Preston. And Lee says, I would love to be composted. Feed the earth and the trees with me, please. So there's clearly some appetite there for it. Tony from Woodside asks, does the preservatives we eat become a problem?
No. The composting method gets to a heat which kills pathogens, and the food we eat, you know, our body digests it. Can I just explain human composting a little bit first?
Mm-hmm.
So the human body is this complex ecosystem of cells and microorganisms. Our body, living on and in us, consists of bacteria, viruses and fungi, just like the earth. And this microbial community plays a vital role in our well-being. When we die, they continue their work. They actually, they literally start decomposing our body and turning it into something different. This is a compost transformation from a body into amended soil, because the way human composting is done is you go into a vessel with organic material such as wood chips and alfalfa or lucerne hay, and you know, anything organic that your family wants to put in there. And because a lot of our body is liquid, so that wood chip material absorbs that liquid.
Yeah.
But those microbial organisms, bacteria, viruses and fungi, they do their work. They go to town.
They go to town, and apparently only takes a few weeks.
They party. Well, it takes about a month. They party hard. About a month, but then after that month, then you kind of, and that's where you reach heats where pathogens are killed and everything breaks down.
So it just takes
a
few weeks.
After that,
yeah, and then it becomes that beautiful, rich compost. Tui, I have to leave
no,
it there.
Well, you've still got another month
still
to
another
cure,
month?
Really.
Yes.
Yeah, to kind of cure and start to dry out a bit.
Tui, thank you so much for letting us know about that. We certainly will be looking on seeing whether this bill makes it in New South Wales. But thank you for letting us know what Earthly Remains has been up to, and we'll keep an interest in it.
Happy to talk anytime. And maybe your listeners could look at the website.
Yep. Earthly Remains is that website from Tui Davidson, who's human composting advocate. Someone was asking what Teresa's charity was. I wrote it down as Earthly Legacy. I haven't looked that
it
up.
Is.
Yep, there
it
we
is
go.
Earthly Legacy.
Yep. I can tell the advocates are all talking. Thank you so much, Tui, for joining us on the Conversation Hour. I'm seeing your texts, and I will get to more of that as the Conversation Hour continues. And also, we've been talking about school suspensions this hour. But I tell you what, some brave people were doing this morning. They were jumping in icy water, and why not? How do you celebrate winter? Tell me about your winter swimming as well, a day after the winter solstice.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, it was the winter solstice yesterday, and people were jumping in naked in the chilly waters off Hobart to celebrate it. I want to know your tips. Look, to be honest, I would have to have a bit of a drive there. Do you do that? Tell me why I should be winter swimming. I want to know. Holly in Opossum Bay. That's in Tasmania, am I right?
Yes, that's right. And sunny Tasmania.
In sunny Tasmania. Day. And did you hop in the drink this morning?
I did, yes. It's a bit of a tradition with me and another friend at the moment. So, had a great time, as we do. Very refreshing.
Were you naked, may I ask? I don't normally ask that, but it was a thing this morning.
Everyone's naked. Yeah,
everyone's naked.
There's about 3,000 of your closest naked friends, and it's the Mona folk give you a white towel and a little red cap, so everyone kind of looks the same. So you can't even sort of recognise people, even if you wanted to. So in you go with all the people, and there's sort of the momentum of the crowd going in. There's just no turning back. And yeah.
When you say you won't recognise someone even if you wanted to, what you're saying is you're just concentrating on getting in the water. Is that it?
It's don't make eye contact is, you know, rule number one. And just run in without any fear. So
what does that feel like when you hit the water naked?
Well, I have to say this year it was actually felt noticeably warmer. So I'm sure some people would be disagreeing with me, but I think the water was about 12 degrees today, but the weather outside was 3, so I was kind of like, get me in there, like, let's go, like, and you sort of go under, you know, maybe to hide yourself or whatever, but once I was under, I just wanted to stay there forever. It was just fun. Like,
do you do this every year, Holly?
I have been doing it for the last 4 years in a row, so I feel like a bit of a latecomer. But I have, since coming back to Tassie, I've been doing it every year.
See, I would have thought that if you've done it even a few times, you'd get way more comfortable with being naked. You're not quite there yet?
Oh, no, I'm
You're
totally
in?
Comfortable.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
Like, I actually feel more comfortable being naked than if I had because if you had a bathers on, then you can kind of get judged by what what your style of bathers or whether it suits your body. But you just go in and, no one sees anything and no one cares and, you never see anyone not having a good time.
I love it. So, Holly, give me your top tip. Why? I can tell why I should do it, but how do I do it? What's going to get me out of bed? What do you think I should be thinking of?
Well, I mean, I guess it's something you can sort of say you've done. Like, that's the reason I did it the first time. I was like, okay, I'd actually heard that two family members had done it. I'm like, okay, well, challenge accepted, you know, I have to be one of them. So, and then you do it once, and then the feeling that you have afterwards, you can't not feel good. And so you just, so then I came back. I mean, I still, the first couple, I had that moment when you're running in going, why am I doing this? Like, this is mad. But then, like I said, you come out, you feel great. You see all these happy people. It's a really nice bookend to an excellent couple of weeks of festival. And it's like a way to kind of kickstart you back into the longer days. And I just don't think you couldn't come out saying you felt worse. So Come on down, Mary, next year.
Okay. Holly, thank you. Holly from Hobart may just get me in next year. Thank you. Philip, you've called from Venus Bay. You're a winter swimmer as well?
Oh, that's right. We're down there every morning, down at number 5 beach, Venus Bay.
Every morning?
So every morning, up us 8, yeah.
So you're not just a winter lover, you're a summer loving it lover.
It's a real sense of community. We started off in COVID and we had about 2 or 3, and now we have regulars of about 8-15 during the week.
Mm. And Philip, as I say, I wouldn't normally ask this, but do you do it naked?
No, you can have, we prefer one pieces or bikinis, or you can wear a spring suit if you like. But I just go in with board shorts. That's my go. I'm sort of totally used to it now.
How long have you been doing it, did you say, Philip?
Since COVID. I met a guy down there going for my walks, and he said, come and join me. And I said, you've got rocks in your head. The only way I'm going into that ocean, it's got to be 45 degrees for about 5 days in a row. And he said, no, just try it. So, and ever since then, it's great. We really have a real sense of community.
Is that the thing that keeps you going, Philip? Sort of like come for the water, stay for the people?
Happening. You find out what's happening in the area. And out of that, I got involved in a ukulele group. We got a film society down there. I run the Tarwin Lower Market. But the only thing I don't like is when people mention that word work. You know, I definitely get shudders when people mention that word.
No mention of work.
No, just go easy on that word, will you? Thanks.
Philip, it sounds like an absolutely delightful group. Thank you. I think between you and Holly, you might have convinced me. Thank you. And a shout out to everyone who is jumping in the water, whatever morning it is, whether it's winter or not. I'd love to still get to a few of your calls. If you are a winter swimmer, tell me why I should be part of it as well. You're listening to The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Now, a little later, we're going to be catching up with Ed Wyatt, our resident American Australian, to tell us about how he did survive, I'm sure pretty nicely, that Socceroos USA showdown on Saturday. But next, the ever-changing and potentially soon to be changing face of UK politics.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, you might have heard there was a by-election in the UK that could literally change politics around the world. Yes, you heard it right. Andy Burnham, we know from the 2010s, used to be in government. Well, he left Westminster, he was a mayor and now is back in the Labour Party in the UK and may take on the very beleaguered PM there, Keir Starmer. To break it all down for us is Ben Wellings, who's Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at Monash University. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Mary.
Can we just get to the scale and the significance of this victory by Andy Burnham in this electorate? How unusual it is to get that sort of turnout and response in a by-election in the UK, let alone beating the far-right parties.
Okay, yes. So there's a lot going on there, Mary. So just to sort of break it down, is listeners might remember that about a month ago there were some elections that went very badly for the Labour Party in England, Scotland and Wales. And this put pressure on Keir Starmer. A lot of people feel that his leadership is lacklustre and he wasn't combating the main threat which is emerging now from the radical right Reform Party. So the problem was is that a lot of people's preferred candidate, Andy Burnham, was mayor of Manchester, and that means he wasn't in Westminster Parliament, which meant he couldn't lead the Labour Party and therefore be Prime Minister. So a slightly convoluted series of events took place where one of Burnham's Westminster MP friends and allies stood down to create a vacancy, create a by-election, which Burnham won on Thursday night or Friday our time. So now Burnham is back in Parliament. And he's positioned well to take on the Labour Party. And the thing that the Labour Party strategists and supporters and enthusiasts will be really keen about is that he seems to be able to unite enough people on the progressive side of politics to counter the threat from the radical right parties. So this is the sort of the importance of it. This is where it's all coming out. And of course, it's quite possible that sooner rather than later, he'll be the Prime Minister of the UK and all that implies for Britain's relations with the rest of the world.
Mm. I'm speaking to Ben Wellings. We're talking about UK politics. And Ben, I mean, the parallels with Australia are bleedingly obvious. You have a Labour Party whose vote has been plummeting against right, and in this case, far right parties, Reform and Restore, Tories, who are, I guess, equivalent to Liberals in the sense that they are centre right, really struggled, in fact, were very big losers out of this election as well. What does it suggest to us, and what might Australians and the Labour Party here take out of the results in terms of what Andy Burnham was offering to people to take them away from those far right? Was it just, can they take a lot out of it, or was it strategic, a smack for the sitting government, for the present MP?
I think there's some really good parallels, and then there are some differences. Mm. So I think if I was a Labour person here looking at that result, I'd be saying, okay, the radical right in Australia's case, One Nation, can be defeated. So the question is how. And I think what Burnham does is focus on locality. So, and this is where there's a slight difference here. You know, Burnham is strongly associated with Manchester and the northwest of England, and these are the deprived areas that feel, or some of them are, that feel left behind by politics. In the way that we get that surge for One Nation, who are articulating the voice, you know, articulating a message for people in rural and regional Australia who also feel left behind by current politics. So I think that Burnham's emphasis on locality and making politics work at a really local level is something that will resonate. And I think that if you like, figuratively moved and literally moves south and takes up the keys to 10 Downing Street, then we'll get a kind of a different emphasis on politics delivering for people in less well-off socio-economic areas, and that means particularly the northern parts of England. Mm. So, you know, so this in this sense, like, service delivery becomes really important. It'd be like nationalising re-nationalising water utilities, just sort of generally kind of like policies that will seek to restore high streets, or, you know, like town centres, basically, which have been somewhat hollowed out, I think, by various kind of consumer developments and those things that really matter to people's everyday lives that they can see around them when they go out of their front door. So that's going to be one of his main areas of focus.
I too thought it is fascinating that you have someone who was very much an insider, if you like, for Westminster, part of the establishment, goes to become a mayor, gets this, as you say, almost branding then as about being just a little outside of politics, as well as being locally connected. My mind goes to Boris Johnson, of course, who was also a mayor but ended up not being a very well-received PM in the end. Is this also a part of that sort of outsider-insider divide that essentially Andy Burnham has rebranded himself, and that's what people are attracted to?
I think it's less like being an outsider. It's more like being from a particular place. So there's a kind of a word that goes with Burnham's type of politics, and it's called Manchesterism. Now, this is very much his signature policy in Manchester was to take control of the buses, take them out of public private ownership, and coordinate them via the city of Manchester off government, right? So it's very focused on service delivery. I mean, the problem here is that, you know, so was Keir Starmer, but, you know, there was not a narrative or an effective delivery. So it's kind of easy to have the insight to say, well, politics has got to work for people in more socioeconomic deprived areas, but making that actually happen is, of course, hard. And governing the UK is more complicated than governing Manchester. So, I mean, he's very much within the sort of like the Labour Party fold. So it's not so much that he's an outsider of politics, but it is a bit unusual if we were to have a Prime Minister of Britain with a Mancunian accent. I mean, that's never happened, right? So that would be the difference, I would say.
Yeah, and there's still a lot that needs to happen. We still haven't heard from Keir Starmer. They're sleeping at the moment, but no doubt he'll be sleeping on whether or not to fall on his sword. Ben Wellings, thank you so much for spelling it out for us.
Thanks, Mary.
That's Ben Wellings, who's Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at Monash Uni. This on text in response, I guess, to my description along the way. Libs in Australia used to be a centre-right party, now a far-right party with policies emulating many of One Nation. John of Coburg loved the fact that on stage, the winning candidate stood on stage between a guy dressed in a six-foot fox costume and Count Binface. Yes, I do love UK elections as well. Gus says, I had a nutty swim sunrise at Summers, only to be swimming with three dolphins. What an experience. Keep those calls and texts coming if you can. We'll try and squeeze them in about winter swimming, about UK politics, about everything. But also wanted to catch up with Ed Wyatt. We pinned him down last week to be talking about who he'd be going for when the Socceroos were taking on USA. He's a dual citizen. He's a sports journalist. And Ed joins us now. Ed, in the end, you needn't have been so nervous, as it turns out.
Hi, Mary. No, you're absolutely right. And I think once the US got that early goal, I was kind of, that sort of took the edge off it a little bit. And I was sort of just going, all right, if Australia can pull one back, great. If the US wins, that's great. As I said, both teams are probably going to go through to the next round. So you're right. I was probably way too stressed out for no reason. It actually wasn't a bad morning, I'll be honest with you.
Well, I mean, you know, our lack of form was unexpected, but we'll move on from that. What do you take from that, though, in terms of both the Socceroos and the US, and what should we be looking forward to this week?
Well, I think a lot of the talk was around that lineup where Tony Popovich didn't start Aaron Kunda or Metcalf, the two guys who scored in the first game. So that was the huge talking point. And the Socceroos look really good in the second half. So I think they just need, the U.S. is in a good spot. They've won this game. They're going to move on. They're going to win the group. Australia now plays Paraguay, who surprisingly beat Turkey. So I think it's going to be a tricky one, although they'll be missing one of their best players, Miguel Almirón. I don't know if you saw this, the guy who first guy sent off for holding his hand over his mouth, which is sort of the anti-racism move from FIFA, which I like, by the way. And so I think Australia should be okay. And even if they lose, there's still a way they can go forward because of this new third place goes through rule. So I think they'll need to be on their best game, that's for sure. But I think they'll be okay and should be able to get through.
Yeah, and you'll be feeling a bit more confident about the US.
Yeah, I think the U.S. looks pretty good, and that was without their best player, arguably Christian Pulisic. So I think that was a really good win for the U.S. Seattle looked magnificent, by the way. I was very homesick watching that, I got to tell you, looking at the blue skies. And there are not many blue skies in Seattle, Mary. So when you see a summer day like that, you just go, ah, magnificent.
You were proud. Ed, thank you so much for bringing us up to date, and we'll keep in touch with you through the World Cup.
No problem. Keep an eye on New Zealand, by the way. They're up on Egypt 1-0. So our friends across the ditch are looking okay right now.
Okay. After the Conversation Hour, everyone tune in. That's Ed Wyatt, American-Australian sports journalist, on this Conversation Hour that covered a lot of topics, including human composting. Penny in North Melbourne, what did you want to say?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Look, I think the disposal of the human body has sort of, you know, traditionally sort of had a lot of religious connections to it. And I think we need to move on from some of that and think about what we're doing to the planet. So I think the whole concept of composting bodies is a very, very environmentally friendly approach. And it just might need a lot of education and perhaps encouraging people to think of the benefits rather than perhaps what they perceive as the horror of it all.
Yeah, That's true. We still have a lot to overcome when we talk about death as well. Penny, what would you like to think that your compost, your remains, would be contributing towards? What would you vote for?
I think just enriching the soil. I like to think I could enrich the soil.
Yeah. A lovely thought. Thank you, Penny. And yeah, as well, lots on text about that. Maybe a solar cemetery. Every grave has a solar panels. That's another thought as well. And also this on text, I'd 100% choose to be composted if it was the most environmentally and cost-effective method available at the time. Still a long way to go. That bill is not even before Parliament in New South Wales. I'm sure it will get a lot of press. Jane in Anglesey says, last night, right at the winter solstice, 6:24 p.m, that is 10 mermaids took to the sea. Some tossed the bathers aside. We had lanterns and lights to keep an eye out for sharks. Talking of that bridge that might have been seen up the coast at Bells, followed by hot chocolate and whiskey. Exhilarating. Jane, you might have just got me over the line on winter swimming. Bassam in Coburg says the best way to describe Tassie waters is a glass of water with ice, and that was a 26 degree day in summer. Yes, you can experience winter all round if you just travel for it. Thank you so much for being with me on The Conversation Hour today on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Catch us again on the ABC Listen app.